time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Steve Breaux. Steve Breaux is public interest advocate at Washburg. His prior experience includes working as the communications manager of the World Affairs Council of Seattle and serving as a member of the communications staff of the Senate Democrats in the Washington legislature. He has also volunteered as an international elections observer with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, in Albania, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Kyrgyzstan. Steve, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Mike.
So to start out, tell us about Washburg.
Washburg is a membership-based organization, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that focuses on delivering activism that protects consumers, encourages a fair, sustainable economy, and fosters responsive democratic government. And we do that in several ways. We actively lobby members of the legislature and Congress to, you know, promote the changes and reforms in government that we believe in. We reach out to the public through public opinion media and direct canvassing to people to sort of let them know what we're working on and try to get them involved at the community level, get them involved in doing things like writing letters to the editor, contacting their elected officials to express their opinions, and trying to get them directly involved in their democracy.
Yeah, I know from over the years I've had your field canvassers come to my door, knock on my door many times. Washburg used to be more involved in environmental issues, is that right?
Yeah, we used to be involved. Actually, it started off very much in consumer affairs and consumer protection type issues, sort of the Ralph Nader movement back in the 70s. And along the way, they did pick up a lot of environmental movement issues. And that's basically been handed off to another organization called, here in Washington State, in Environment Washington. And so we spend a little bit less time focusing on the environmental stuff because there's so many environmental issues that alone could be just overwhelming. And so we focus on other core issues such as, you know, consumer protection, good government, financial reforms, things like that.
All right. So one of the issues that you focus on and focused on this last legislative session are electoral issues. And, in fact, you're receiving an award today from another fine group here.
Yes, we are. We'll be receiving the Organization of the Year Award this evening from Washington Public Campaigns for some of the work that we did during the 2011 legislature. We had a lot in common on the bills that we were looking at, specifically on public financing of state Supreme Court elections, some campaign finance transparency laws, asking for some revisions to the initiative process in Washington State, particularly the filing fees, which was something important. We were very disappointed that that did not go forward, but something that maybe we can talk about a little bit later on. And then there was another bill that would have allowed people or allowed election commissions to actually start tabulating votes 36 hours before the end of an election. And one state senator thought that that would be a great idea to help clear the backlog of votes that needed to be counted here in King County, because King County is always, you know, the last county to report just by virtue of its size. The problem with that would have been that if you've got, you know, a locked facility where they're actually counting the votes 36 hours before the election's over, you've got a serious issue with the public perception that, hey, they're already counting the votes. Why am I bothering to vote? And then someone, of course, could come forward and say, well, I know that so-and-so is winning in King County because I've got a friend in there who, you know, called me on his cell phone and said so-and-so is up by 5%. And whether or not that's true, that kind of political gamesmanship could actually, you know, call the integrity of the elections process into question. So we were very opposed to that. Fortunately, that bill didn't get very far in Olympia.
All right, so talk more about the work you were doing with transparency on political campaign financing.
The issue there, it arose during the 2010 election. There was a state Senate race involving an incumbent, Gene Berkey, and some liberal groups were not very happy with the job that she was doing. She was a moderate Democrat, and they thought that they needed to sort of fire a warning shot across the bow of the more moderate Democrats. And so what they did was, since we have a top two primary system in Washington State, where the top two proceed regardless of party, they wanted to try to see if they could get a more liberal Democrat to beat her in the primary. But they did it in a roundabout way by having a campaign consultant basically have sort of a shadow campaign to support another candidate and siphon votes off. And the problem there wasn't necessarily with the strategy. The problem was the fact that they were hiding where the money was coming from and where it was going to. And they were reporting it so late in the reporting process that no one knew until after the fact. And indeed, what ended up happening was a more liberal Democrat ended up getting more votes than Gene Bernanke, and he ended up getting elected. And there were some calls by some members of the legislature to refuse that new senator his seat until an investigation could be done. The Attorney General's office ended up looking into the actual campaign strategist that executed this plan. And it was very embarrassing. So the Senate brought forward a bill to address the issue of campaign finance disclosure requirements. And one of the biggest issues in that was the PAC-to-PAC contributions. There weren't any limits on how you could transfer money from one political action committee to another. And typically, you know, when you receive a mailer during election season and it says, you know, paid for by Washingtonians for a Better Washington. Well, who the heck is that? Well, they got their money from Americans for a Better America. Well, who the heck is that? And this is the game that's played to basically hide where the money's coming from and who's raising it and where it's going. And initially, the legislation was going to prohibit PAC-to-PAC contributions. And we thought that was a great idea. We want people to be able to more easily find out who is donating political money, who is accepting political money, who's spending the political money. And you can do that right now on the state's Public Disclosure Commission's website. The problem is that you sort of need to know how the system works. And the PAC-to-PAC contributions just make it that much harder to dig through the records and find out what's going on. When I initially testified on the bill, there was some very, you know, vocal opposition to it. And I think that's great. I mean, we should have vocal debate in a democracy. That's what our system is supposed to be all about. By the time that piece of legislation made it all the way through the political process and made it to the floor of each chamber of the legislature, it was supported unanimously. And the reason it ended up with unanimous support was it ended up being so watered down that was virtually meaningless. Instead of having a complete prohibition on PAC-to-PAC transfers of financial contributions, you ended up with a clause that said, well, the originating PAC can transfer their money to another PAC, provided that they have 10 contributing members who are registered voters who contributed a minimum of $10 each. Which, when you think about it, isn't really that much of a prohibition. I mean, anybody who's sponsoring a PAC, they've got a spouse, they've got siblings, they've got parents, they've got friends. I call this the friends and family calling circle exemption, because basically you could get on your cell phone, use your friends and family calling plan, and hit up 10 people with $10 each. If you can't find a way around this loophole, you've got no business in Washington state politics. You know, you could walk out in the hall in Olympia and come back with, you know, signatures from 10 people who have $10 in their pocket. And what would happen, we're concerned about what would happen, is basically it's a technical loophole that's really not going to end up doing much of anything to prohibit large sums of money being transferred from one political action committee to another. And so in the end, we ended up not supporting what ended up passing. And we really do wish that they had done something. I mean, if they want to have some kind of a system where you allow those transfers, we would have been happier with they call it the 10-10 prohibition or the 10-10 loophole. You 10 people giving $10 each, that makes a PAC supposedly, you know, legitimate grassroots, whatever. We would have preferred to see a 110 exemption or a 1,010 exemption where, you know, if you want to transfer all that money, fine, you need to have 1,000 people who gave $10 each. That would demonstrate that you're a sincere grassroots effort that has, you know, real public support. Instead of an organization where you've got one guy, you know, you could have anyone. You could have George Soros on the left or the Koch brothers on the right come into Washington State and want to influence an election by making a huge cash contribution. But they don't want their fingerprints on it, obviously. So they form a PAC, and they want to transfer the money to someone else. Well, what do? Find 10 people with $10 each. And so instead of George Soros donating, you know, $1 billion, he donates $1 billion, and then these other people kick in $10 each. So it's $1,100,000.
So what's the thinking on why, what's their argument for having PACs donating to PACs? How is that like something good for democracy?
Well, I don't think that it is anything very good for democracy. The people that testified in opposition to the original bill were basically saying, well, it's freedom of speech. It's along the same lines of corporate citizenhood, where you know, they're people too, even though they aren't legitimately, you know, or legally, well, I guess legally they are right now, according to the Supreme Court decisions. You know, a corporation has citizenship and they can participate in the political process by making campaign contributions. And some people say, well, the same thing with PACs. Some of the other restrictions in the bill were how you could name the Political Action Committee. Instead of having an amorphous name like Washingtonians for a Better Washington, having a name that more accurately describes what the organization is and what it supports, and disclosing who sits on the committee, you know, having the names of the top five donors listed on campaign material. But in the end, it was largely a wash. And I think that whenever you see a piece of legislation that passes unanimously in both chambers of a legislative body, you have to stop and think, how serious was this? I mean, when you think about what passes with 100% support, well, you know, a resolution honoring American mothers, you know, a resolution saying kittens are cute, those are the kind of things that get unanimous support. And I think they missed a real opportunity here, because when you think about the strategy of what was involved, you're bringing forward a bill for campaign finance reform, which you would think sounds like a good thing. So it would have taken a certain amount of courage to vote no on it, knowing that when you're up for re-election, your opponent is going to say, incumbent so-and-so voted no on campaign finance reform. They should have used that to leverage people to voting for this. And again, they didn't need unanimous support to pass the legislation. I mean, we've got a democracy here. They only need a simple – this bill didn't involve any taxing issues, so it didn't fall under 1053. They only needed a simple majority in each chamber to pass this. I'm all in favor of compromise up until the point where the compromise ends up in being a meaningless compromise. You don't have to sell the farm to get compromise. And unfortunately, I think they compromised a little bit too much on this bill, and I'm hoping maybe they'll revisit it next year.
All right. Let's talk briefly about public financing, which is something Washburg supported.
Yeah, we've supported public financing campaigns in the past, and this year there was a bill before the legislature to provide public financing of state Supreme Court races. And they were looking at that sort of as, you know, a test bed, a prototype for further public financing of campaigns. It was seen as probably a good candidate for that type of reform, because state Supreme Court races are supposed to be nonpartisan in Washington State. So they thought, well, that takes the political parties out, because right now the political parties can't contribute to state Supreme Court races. So they don't have a dog in the fight technically, although everyone knows that when you got two people running for the state Supreme Court, it's pretty easy to tell which one's the Democrat and which one's the Republican. But a lot of people thought that would be a good first shot at getting publicly financed campaigns in Washington State. Unfortunately, there is a very serious budget issue in Washington State, and the financing was the issue, is where do you come up with the money? And even though it would be an excellent investment in democracy, we simply don't have the money to invest right now. And I don't think that bill even made it out of the first committee where it had the hearing, just because they just assumed that when it finally hit the Ways and Means Committee, why bother? I think that was the attitude.
All right. And then briefly, the initiative filing fees, why is that a big deal?
That was actually a very interesting bill to debate, because it addressed two different things. The topic that was getting the most attention when I went to Olympia to testify on this bill was actually the requirement in that legislation that people who gather signatures for initiatives be registered, and that people who file initiatives or sponsor initiatives be registered. And there was a lot of backlash against that. Obviously, Tim Iman was there opposing it, and his funders were there opposing it. And actually, I think the ACLU actually showed up to oppose it. A lot of people had philosophical problems with why should someone have to register if they want to go out and gather signatures. And they said, well, gee, fraud's not really that big of an issue, and why do we need these protections? And there was a lot of back and forth on that. And on that specific issue, I thought, well, you have to register to do anything else in politics in Washington State. You have to register to run for office. You need to register to vote. why shouldn't you need to register? And technically, you need to be a registered voter to sign an initiative. So why shouldn't we have the added protection of registering the people who are circulating the petitions so that if there is an issue with a petition, if it turns out that there's some kind of fraud or forgery or something like that, we can track it back to the person who was circulating that petition and know who they were and know whether or not they were being paid and who paid them and how this happened. There was a very heated debate over that. Another part of the bill that was sort of overlooked and where we were taking a lead on this was the filing fee. In Washington State, if you want to sponsor an initiative, you pay a $5 filing fee to the Secretary of State's office. That's the limit that was put in place a century ago when the initiative and referendum process was added into our election process. And there's a huge problem with that because taxpayers are basically subsidizing the rest of the process. When you file an initiative, you take it to the Secretary of State's office, they need to process that initiative. They need to look at it to see if it's worded properly. They need to check it against existing law. They need to run through the code revisor's office. They need to assign it a number on the ballot. That costs a heck of a lot more than $5 in staff time and resources for the Secretary of State's office to do. But right now they're only collecting $5. And you may not have noticed, or maybe you have, when you get your ballot in the mail on an election, you've got several initiatives on there. And they're not consecutively numbered. They skip around. The reason they skip around is when initiatives are filed with the Secretary of State's office, he gets a whole bunch of them, and he gives them sequential numbers. But professional initiative sponsors, they want to have certain numbers. Certain numbers sound better from a marketing perspective. So they file virtually the identical piece of initiative paperwork with subtle changes, a comma here, a period there, something like that. The same thing, maybe 10 copies of the exact same initiative. They end up getting the numbers put on them. They then take those back to their marketing gurus and say, which of these 10 has the best number from a marketing perspective? That's the one they run. The others, they set them aside, they trash them, they withdraw them, whatever. And that's why you end up with, I mean, if you go to Secretary of State's office right now, sos.wa.gov, there's a sub-site on there where you can look at all the initiatives that are filed. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of initiatives filed. And you've got, like, Tim Iman has 10 initiatives filed on the same thing. And then another 10 initiatives filed on another thing. But he'll only end up running maybe one on each one, maybe not even one on each one. Maybe one of them he's just filing just for the heck of it because he doesn't know what he wants to do a year from now, but he's filing the paperwork now. And so, so basically the taxpayers are subsidizing Tim Iman's marketing efforts on his campaigns. We're subsidizing his marketing research. And so the bill would have required the fee be raised from $5 to $500, which still doesn't cover the full cost for the Secretary of State's office staff to do the work. But it would have more accurately reflected the true cost for the Secretary of State's office to do their job in processing these initiatives. And there were two very interesting aspects to that. One was, if you were an organization that didn't have $500, you could submit signatures in place of cash, showing that you're not a professional, you're a genuine grassroots organization that has real public support, this is a genuine issue, you sincerely intend to move forward with this, so you can substitute signatures for cash. And if your initiative qualified for the ballot, you would receive a refund of, I think it was $450 out of the $500, you would have received a refund on the money you put forward, because you would have demonstrated good faith in actually moving forward. There's one initiative filed right now, and this happens all the time, an initiative filed to change the state song. Every year there are a bunch of these things. They're practical joke initiatives. And somebody says, hey, I have an idea. Let's file an initiative to change the state song from, I don't know what it is. I don't care what it is, frankly. But it's a practical joke because he only has to pay $5 to do it. Who's going to pay $500 to file a practical joke initiative to, you know, make the official state dog or change the official state song or something like that. So this would have definitely saved the taxpayers money on curbing, you know, abuse of the initiative process by practical jokers and getting the professional initiative sponsors to actually pick up the tab for running their business instead of us funding their businesses.
So was the registration for all initiative gatherers, both paid and non-paid?
Yeah.
Okay.
It would have involved registering anyone who circulates an initiative, and some organizations had problems with that. And eventually, this bill didn't get very far. It didn't go anywhere, in large part because of the signature, the registering of signature gatherers. That ran into a lot of problems. And again, I think that maybe they could have done something by simply amending the legislation, striking all of that out, and keeping just the filing fee portion. I think that's something where it wouldn't have had 1053 issues because it's a fee, not a tax. So they could have passed it with a simple majority. I think it would be very hard to justify keeping a $5 filing fee when we know that the cost to the taxpayers is much higher than that. And again, it's a 100-year-old price tag. That's definitely due for some revision.
Very good. Let's move on to another area that you focused on this last legislative session, and that was removing tax loopholes and/or tax exemptions. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, we were very active with a coalition to try to encourage the legislature to look at some way of balancing the budget other than simply cut, cut, cut. You know, the governor basically came forward with an all-cuts budget. And the legislature proceeded along those lines, and I don't know what the exact figure is. I think it's fair to say it's probably like a 99% cuts budget. They raised a few little fees here and there. But we worked with the Our Economic Future Coalition very early in the legislative process to try to encourage state legislators to look at things like, you know, corporate subsidies, corporate tax loopholes, exemptions to things in the B&O tax law that simply really don't make a lot of sense. A lot of these things are put in place with the idea that they will help stimulate economic activity, that will end up generating revenue in the long term, and in some circumstances those actually do work. But some of them are so old and so antiquated, and very few of them have any sunset provisions. So once these things go into effect, they never die. And you've got ridiculous situations in the state where hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in taxes are not being collected because a certain industry that had an effective lobbyist at some point in time, maybe 100 years ago, got a tax loophole put in place. And it's still in place. We have the most egregious example was played up quite a bit where there is an exemption on bedding materials for chickens in Washington state. And it's costing the state, you know, it's a drop in the bucket in the grand scheme of things, but it's real money. And when you think about it from a fairness perspective, if you buy a new crib for a newborn baby, you pay tax on that crib. But if you buy bedding materials for chickens, you don't have to pay sales tax on it. If you buy, you know, heating oil or electricity or propane to heat your home, you have to pay sales tax on that. But if you buy propane for the specific purpose of heating a chicken coop, you don't have to pay sales tax on that. It's fundamentally unfair. And we think that that along with, you know, from something trivial like that all the way up to, you know, the $100 million a year exemption for big banks in Washington state on the mortgages they process that was originally put in place to protect Washington Mutual against out-of-state banks that were writing mortgages in Washington state. It was done to help prop up WAMU. Well, Washington Mutual isn't there anymore, but they still will not repeal that subsidy or that loophole. And the reason, frankly, is because a lot of politicians take these, you know, no new taxes pledges, and in their warped minds, repealing a loophole is the same thing as raising a tax. And that is not codified in law. I don't know that the courts have ever agreed with that, but they just don't have the political courage to challenge it. And we were pushing very hard to find someone to do that. Very late in the session, a group of Senate Democrats came forward with some bills, including rolling back things like the exemptions on bedding materials for chickens, and all the way up to trying to move legislation that would put a referendum to the voters clarifying whether or not rolling back a tax loophole is actually raising taxes and asking the voters yes or no, does this make sense? And that would draw the line whether or not the legislature needs a simple majority to do that or a supermajority to do that. But they've been acting under the assumption that it requires a supermajority. And it's an untested assumption. And we were very frustrated that they simply didn't go there. They rolled out these bills, and that was it. They didn't really move on anything.
So they could have at least shown, you know, a degree of spine by lateraling that to the voters and letting us decide.
Sure.
And
or even internally in the legislature, bring it up for a vote and make those legislators stand up and say, yes, I believe in exempting chickens from taxes. You know, if they believe in these loopholes that much, then stand up and say so. Make the case instead of simply giving them a pass on it and having the courage to even have the discussion.
All right, we've only got a few minutes left, and I want you to talk a bit about the Foreclosure Fairness Act.
Great. This is something that came out of the legislature that it's something that most people don't know about yet, unfortunately. Everyone thinks that the legislature did a terrible job this year, but one area where they really did a great service to the taxpayers and to the people of Washington is on the issue of foreclosures. We passed this year in the 2011 legislature a Foreclosure Fairness Act. It basically brings a mediation process to foreclosures in Washington state. Right now, Washington is a non-judicial foreclosure state, which means if you're being foreclosed on, it's you against the bank. And I don't know very many people that would relish that fight. What this does is it puts in place, effective on July 22nd, a process where the banks will have to pay a $250 fee to the state for every foreclosure they file. That money is going to be used to help train mediators. And if you receive a foreclosure notice, you'll be able to request a mediator to step in, and that mediator will basically assess whether or not the financial institutions are acting in good faith on your particular mortgage. And they will try to work, find a way to help you stay in your home that works for you and works for the bank. This was originally put in place, I think, in Nevada, where they've seen in some areas a 60% drop in the foreclosure rates or the actual foreclosures. We are only the third non-judicial state in the country to have this, along with Nevada and Maryland. And we're hoping that when that goes into effect on July 22nd, we'll actually see some success with that. We worked very hard with the Alliance to Prevent Predatory Lending to help promote this. We had some very compelling testimony from people who were being foreclosed on, and then along with experts who were explaining how this would help. The banks were initially opposed to it, but we brought them around. They actually came to the table in the end and worked with us on this. The Statewide Poverty Action Network was really the ones who spearheaded this, brought this coalition together. Washburg was very excited to be a part of it because we saw the need from the consumer protection standpoint of, you know, this is something where the little guy, the average consumer, needs someone to help them, you know, be on a level playing field against the big bank when the bank tries to foreclose on you. So we're really glad that the State Poverty Action Network took the lead on that. And if anyone needs any information on that, they should probably, the best source right now would be to go to their website at www.povertyaction.org. They've got a page dedicated to that, and they'll be putting up more information on what they can do to get a mediator once that goes into effect. There's also a state hotline that they can call to request a housing counselor or someone to help them out with that, and that is 1-877-894-HOME. And again, starting July 22nd, that will be a big plus for homeowners in Washington state.
And will people who are facing foreclosure, will they be told about the that they can get a mediator? Is there a requirement that they're told and informed about that?
I believe there's a requirement in there that they be told about that, but they have to specifically request it. It's not something that automatically occurs during the foreclosure process. They have to actively seek, and they need to be referred to a mediator. They can't seek out a mediator on their own. But it's being embedded into the process, and we're going to be tracking that very carefully over, you know, the first 6 months and then the first year of the process to see what's working, what's not. You know, no plan is perfect. We're hoping that it helps a great number of people in Washington State prevent losing their homes.
We're talking with Steve Breaux. He is a public interest advocate at Washburg. And how can people find out more about Washburg?
People can find out more about Washburg by visiting our website, which is www.washpirg.org. And they can also find us on Facebook.
Very good. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.